Hello again, everybody. Though you likely know by now, I'm glad to remind you that I'm Nate Bennett. This is the third episode of Chefaleptic, my autobiographical podcast series. Some subjects discussed in this episode are the dirty secret of a disability, loss of patience as a patient, and life lessons learned from feeding a hungry homeless community. If you enjoyed this episode, and or it makes you think of someone who might as well, let them know about it. After all, it's free, so they won't get burned on the deal. Chapter 8.
Concealed.
I don't know exactly how many seizures I've had. At some point, I was advised to start keeping a journal of all seizure events. It took me a while to take that advice totally seriously, basically because these events seemed so intense and dramatic, yet for so long they were still so irregular. At first, I figured I'd never be able to forget having a seizure even if I tried to. Eventually, that became an unfortunate underestimation, and I realized that this journaling thing was going to be important as I began having them more and more. Over time, I gradually put together the most correct and detailed journal I could make from every source I could find. This included a couple of old dead wall calendars I had been writing notes on. I came across them at some point in my old papers, and they proved my journal had been missing some past episodes. It seemed very likely then that my journal was probably missing other events as well. I don't have a very good memory at this point, and the past 10 or 12 years seem to be doing especially lousy. Sometimes, I have to research these shady areas of my memory to really put together what was going on from my present perspective of now. Over time, one of the most important resources for me has been my totally fucking awesome, love him forever, and probably owe him for saving my life brother Brian. Sorry, bro, couldn't stop myself there. He was my roommate from 96 on through the next dozen or so years in several houses. The last 7 of those years were after I was diagnosed and starting to have more frequent and worsening seizures, which were causing varying levels of amnesia. He was my constant resource for putting back together whatever had happened as I'd recover from episodes. Brian was there for my first diagnosed round of seizures in late 1999, and he saw plenty more over the years. Usually, I'd lose some amount of time, depending on the severity of the seizures, and he repeatedly helped me backfill the story I'd lose, often by patiently answering the same questions I'd ask over and over as I recovered and got my shit back together. A good example question I'd ask would be, "What day is it?" which he told me was a standard. He didn't end up being the only one to help me in this compassionate and patient way over the years. My bro saw the story unfold from the beginning. He was there not only as I came out of the fog from that first emergency room experience, but he saw how the whole connected mess grew and deepened. He watched me lose my driver's license, which the DMV took after that episode for 6 months the first time. He watched me opening all the notices and bills and finding out more and more ways I was going to owe money over that event. And he knew why, for a while, I was sneaking to work on my motorcycle. He also knows how little we understood along the way until each step forced us both to learn more. I'm sure I'm now missing some journal entries from the time period after my first diagnosed round, but I don't have any details in the notes I still have. I do know that the seizures weren't yet happening regularly at that point, but in retrospect, I know I didn't go without trouble for as big of a gap as my journal shows. At some point, I had gotten my driver's license back. This had taken me jumping through numerous hoops laid out by the Special Operations Division of the DMV, including getting a specialist to confirm that they had examined the results of both an EEG, electroencephalogram, and an MRI, a high-tech, expensive-ass picture of my head. I ended up having to pay for both of these completely out of pocket, on top of the ambulance bill and the emergency room bill, as I learned the hard way that everything would be tied to a pre-existing condition by the insurance that I eventually obtained. I remember thinking many times that I'd have done much better if I'd gotten busted with a DUI. Also frustrating for me then was that both of the tests were inconclusive. Neither had explained why I had the seizures. I do recall that once I had that damn license back, I very much wanted to keep it. From the moment I had realized that my seizures were being watched by Big Brother, I felt strong pressure to keep any seizures to myself if I wanted to continue to be able to commute to my job, especially once I finally had active working insurance benefits. I just had to keep on rolling along, not getting busted like any other common criminal trying not to get caught again. Chapter 9,
Doctor versus Patients.
Right from my first trip to the ER, things had started off lousy regarding my doctor versus patient relations when it came to my seizures. The first doctors that had dealt with me in the ER had kicked me to the curb when they found out that I didn't have insurance and reported me to the DMV without explaining much, like how I'd be getting my license pulled and all that. I had started a real me versus them relationship with the world of medicine. I realized, in looking over my old paperwork, that I was being referred to the poor folks bin right from the first time I left the ER. Faded-looking copies and carbon copy forms of everything about how to make payments and being ready to prove you don't have any money was the standard during that whole them and me stretch. Getting the specialist to tell the DMV I was okay to drive wasn't easy either, which back then I saw as essential to being able to keep my job and insurance. Knowing all I know now, I've got to give it the old if I knew then what I knew now excuse and admit that I was a lousy patient. I had been inspired to distrust doctors by the workings of the larger system, even though the workings of that system were really not their fault. I thought of my first specialist, who I'll call Dr. X, as being less about trying to help me and more like representing the big hand of government pointing at me, commanding me to jump through hoops to get my license back so I could, legally, drive to work. A lousy way to start a doctor-patient relationship. I'd still make the point, however, that out of the two of us, I wasn't the professional, and I know I didn't end up getting plenty of info I would have benefited from quickly or easily. What Dr. X didn't handle well was filling me in on the real deal. I didn't get much info about the diagnosis and about the heavy stuff it could mean for my future, and I didn't get informed about real dangers such as status epilepticus. I was handed a pamphlet or two to read, which gave me a few more in-depth details, but I soon realized that the reality was that Dr. X and I now were in a relationship triangle with the DMV, and this doctor had to cover their ass first, whether they liked it or not. I knew very soon that if I had any episodes and told this doctor about them, I was also telling the DMV to take my license, which inspired me to keep my mouth shut, minimizing the likelihood that this doctor would be able to really give me the ideal treatment. This was years ago, and I'd like to think that by now Dr. X has figured out how to start things off better with the patient in this situation so a more honest and productive relationship begins. But again, I know that the external forces involved must constantly make this difficult. Anyway, Dr. X and I seemed to share the minimum information we possibly could with each other to get it over with. I was put on medication called Dilantin, also known as phenytoin. That's one of the oldest and cheapest medications used for controlling seizures, which is why they often try that one first, but it comes with some really sleepy side effects. I had to take it twice a day and was warned that if I stopped taking it abruptly, seizures could be triggered, which could make me even more likely to have seizures. Great. And that's where my meds officially began, and PharmaCorp Town has had me in its grip ever since. So, as directed, I took this stuff. Now, I had done any number of drugs over the years, mostly smoking weed, and I wasn't really afraid of what it might do to me. What I did begin to visualize, though, was that now I was becoming an end user of some kind of perpetual motion machinery gets me needing to take pills so I don't seize, which in turn makes me one heck of a solid customer, which then feeds money it gradually milks out of me on up through the pharma industry, which happens to be best buddies with the government, which controls the hand that is holding my driver's license, making sure that I take the pills so I can drive and work so that I can make money to buy more pills. And almost everybody wins. Anyways, the drug was a drag. Made me tired all the time. I woke up feeling like I was ready to hit the hay. At first, I thought I might get used to it, but it just kept me down. A cheap, boring downer. And certainly not inspiring. Although I wasn't a big drinker then, it didn't take me too long to notice it didn't mix well with alcohol. I found that a single beer would make me want to pass out, yawning and everything. But I took the pills anyhow and just told myself I'd have to skip the drinks. I needed to be able to show with a blood draw or piss test or whatever that I was taking the stuff so my doctor could tell the government I was taking it like a good boy. And then the doctor told me the DMV things were okay and I got the license back and I was finally able to drive to work legally at some point, at least for a while. After a while, I got so tired of that medication, I finally asked Dr. X about the possibility of trying a different kind. This was the beginning of the end of my patience as a patient. It was the first time after all this that I was made aware that there might be other kinds of pills I could try. Not only that, but there were many other brands and forms and even combinations of medications that I was not aware of up to that point. When I reacted with shock and surprise, a sort of nonchalant response like, "Of course there are," came back from this doctor with whom I was receiving care. I was switched to a medication with brand name Lamictal, generic name Lamotrigine, which was more expensive, but better on the side effects. It didn't really work either, but I had to try something. Unfortunately, no doubt due in part to that wonderful doctor-patient relationship and all, I wasn't aware that there were like many, many other kinds of medications I could have tried much sooner if I didn't like the side effects. I just knew the doctor said, "Take this so I can drive," and I said, "Yes, doctor." My doctor said it was right for me. End of discussion. I had been on that stuff for like 2 years before I complained and finally found out there were a number of other medication options possibly available to me. What can I say? My fault. Lesson learned. Should have asked sooner. Now I realize that it was my own damn fault for not doing my own research and asking the doctor to try something else when I found that the cheap shit I was on had lousy side effects or realized it wasn't totally effective. I mean, I was able enough to have gone online and done some reading, so I know now that I had myself to blame first for not asking sooner. But when I found out that this had not been explained to me after a number of visits, I did realize it was time to get another doctor. I asked to see someone else, but it turned out to be the spouse of Dr. X, and when I explained why I wasn't happy with the care I'd gotten, it made things, well, uncomfortable. Soon after that, I had more seizures and told this new doctor about them. Thankfully, I was then referred up the chain to the neurology division at Stanford Hospital, about 45 miles away from Santa Cruz. Chapter 10.
Chiropractical.
My next journaled grand mal seizure was in July 2001. By then, as I recall, poorly, I had gotten somewhat used to dealing with the injuries that came along with whatever seizures I was having and hiding, and I had toughed it out more than once as I bounced back from them. For some reason, though, I had so much pain in my back after this one that after a couple of days, I knew I was in some deeper trouble and I had to get some help. It was a Saturday, and I opened the phone book and looked up a local chiropractor nearby. I ended up being very glad I did so. Dr. Whitelaw answered and asked me a few questions. I told him I was in a lot of pain, especially in my mid-torso, and I could not go to the emergency room. I explained that I was afraid of the aftermath that would come from seeking official medical attention, and he was very honest with me as to whether or not he would be forced to report my seizure to the authorities.
Thankfully, it turned out that, at least at that time, he was not required to do so. He told me that his office was actually closed that day, but he was there doing some cleaning up and he could take a look at me. Another big plus was that he had an X-ray machine and could take a picture to look at. I'll never forget what I realized I had forgotten when he first held the X-ray he took up to the light and said, "Well, Nate, it looks like you fell 6 to 8 feet and landed on your butt." Damn, I realized right away what must have happened. At me and my bro Brian's house, I slept in a finished part of the attic. This meant that I had been climbing up the ladder and had let go during a seizure. It was kind of bound to happen at some point, I guess. As we went through that and several other of my injuries, more and more riddles were answered. I had probably smacked the back of my head on a certain cabinet when I had landed. My tongue had been bitten really badly, and the doctor offered that I may have also bitten it on impact. I had a compression fracture in one, possibly several, of my vertebrae, which is apparently a sign that a person is losing consciousness and falling with full force on their butt from a standing position. I asked him what a hospital would do for me that he couldn't. The answer there was painkillers. He couldn't prescribe them, but he could get me in a brace and set up a program to make sure I healed right. I told him that I had already dealt with enough pain for however long it had been since that seizure that I knew I could make it without them. We worked out a payment plan, all cash, and I saw him for adjustments for the next couple of months. At first, I saw him 3 times a week, then 2x a week, then 1x a week, until I was standing tall again without pain. Somehow, I kept my job and kept on working through it all. I know some people have good results from chiropractic medicine, and some do not. I'm not even going to dig into what whys and what's may be lurking in this subject, but I will say that I was glad that I found this doctor and that his treatment and his advice helped me. Thank you, Dr. Whitelaw. Great work.
Chapter 11. From serving guests to feeding clients.
Around springtime of 2001, things weren't exactly hopping at the resort. I had started in the spring of 99, and we had always been plenty busy since then, but now the big banquet business was slowing down. Thing was, as I came to understand, the dot-com bubble was beginning to burst. My job had largely been about feeding that bubble and tickling its dribbling, bloated appetite with whatever indulgences it demanded. See, that resort I worked at was what liked to be thought of as a real classy operation. A 4-star, oops, I mean diamond situation, where customers were called guests by staff and ice swans graced banquet tables at lunchtimes. I had begun in fast food and had managed to work my way on up through the food industry to then be working right next to the ocean, feeding real live VIPs. But then, I recall how I started seeing some familiar company names in the news. I remember more like overhearing it from a distance as it got started. This company is folding, that company is done, and repeatedly thinking to myself, hey, I feed them at work. See, the Silicon Valley is more or less about 1.5 hours inland from there, and for a while there, these companies were like trying to outdo each other by indulging their upper tiers with pampering, so they rotated through the resort for both working and relaxing hours. For all their breaks, the team I worked with fed them, and very well. It was a big kitchen, and I got to learn a lot. Most of the people I worked with were cool, and some had even become friends. And there was always plenty of work, until then anyways. All of a sudden, business slowed right down, and people began to get scheduled for less hours. When I learned that working too few hours would cause insurance to be interrupted, I threw my little tantrum and got my hours back. But then they'd start vanishing again, and it became clear that the ice swan lunches weren't recovering, which made sense with the companies having their investors flip out about all kinds of overreaching and waste that I helped feed. It became clear that I'd better start looking for something more solid. I had learned enough to know by then that I had damn well better not let my insurance supply run out. A few months later, I pulled up outside of the H
CSC for a job interview. I had followed up on an ad in a local paper, and somehow, even when I'd spoken with someone on the phone to set up the interview, I hadn't managed to learn exactly what the acronym HCSC represented. I had just seen a short, simple ad in a local paper that read something like, HCSC cook needed, solid hours benefits, and that was good enough to interest me, so I guess I just didn't think to ask when I set it up. It took till I pulled up in front of the facility for me to learn that I would be interviewing for a cooking position at the Homeless Center of Santa Cruz. I knew this was going to be a learning experience for sure. When I began at the Homeless Center, I had already laid out a few guidelines for myself. One of them, I believe, formed in my mind right as I walked onto the property. Whatever my views or politics may or may not have been, I would have to leave them at home if I wanted to keep this workable for very long. I learned to describe my approach to the job this way. Those people over there want to pay me to feed these people here in front of me with whatever is in this budget. Now, why were these people here and hungry, and why did those people want to feed them? Not my job. My main feat would become doing the best I could with the knowledge I was working with to feed our clientele the most safe and nutritious meals I could come up with on the most meager budget I could have ever imagined. When I began managing the kitchen a short time after I started working there, that came out to being something in the neighborhood of 7.5 cents per meal. Tellingly, it was a number I had to calculate, as apparently nobody had yet actually taken our meal count and crunched it into our food budget. And sure enough, many times as I worked as this facility's food service director over the next 3 years, I found I had to keep a lot of my own feelings internalized. It was all part of a larger test. The area was then, and is ever more so now, in a conundrum when it came to the homelessness situation. I had learned more and more about this issue from the time I had moved there back in 95, but not necessarily because it was particularly interesting to me or anything. I had just gradually learned about it because living there in the Santa Cruz area puts the issue in your face, especially when you go downtown. Almost anyone who might visit or move to the area would very likely find themselves asking some pretty basic questions about the homeless, like, why are they here? How do they stay alive? Why are there so many? And, if the outsider ended up staying around for a while, why does there always seem to be more and more of them? These questions hadn't really plagued me every day before I arrived in that part of the world. Where I had come from, I knew there were folks that weren't well off, but these were less visible, largely because it's much colder in Michigan, so if you don't keep your ass inside for a good amount of the time, you'll freeze to death. There were some shelters and soup kitchens back there, but somehow the weather factor shielded the homeless community somewhat from obvious view. Whereas there in California for a good part of the year, sleeping outside meant you would most likely live, making this segment of the population much more conspicuous. Warmer weather meant folks could usually make it through nights with some cardboard under bushes or bridges or whatever, as long as there was some food around. And my job was now going to be feeding this community of people. Clearly, there was some ironic lesson for me to learn along this twisted path that had moved me from making some Sunday brunch munching asshole an omelet on a single egg white with smoked salmon and cream cheese folded in quarters to figuring out how to get a nutritious, adult-sized meal together for less than a dime. I couldn't help but make the joke more than once after the whole dot-com bubble popped that sometimes I thought I saw some of the same faces I used to feed at the resort waiting in line for trays at the HCSC. I know I would have enjoyed such a moment for sure if I had ever looked out there and saw that one omelet guy who had held up the whole line of Sunday brunch resort guests waiting in line for their omelets as I had carefully crafted his little two-bite indulgence. That never happened, though. What did happen was that I realized that in this crazy place, I had found a hungry crowd that was more solidly dependable than those risk-taking indulgers I had formerly thought would be the most likely to provide me with a solid stream of food work. There in Santa Cruz, the homeless were, and certainly still are, hungry every day, and that town was decidedly going to pay someone to feed them.
At that time, it was me and a kitchen staff of about 3 or 4 other cooks, aided by a varying number of volunteers. I had started in a regular staff position, but let's just say after a short time, it became clear that I was best suited to be the administrator of the kitchen, so I was promoted. It has expanded over time, but when I started, the facility was basically a paved lot area in front of a large converted warehouse building that had been remodeled to have separate areas providing various services for the homeless. At the front of the building was a small office section, and the first door beyond the offices led into a kitchen area. The next door led into the dining area, which was set up similar to a school lunchroom. The next section of the building was a dry storage area behind large roll-up doors left from the original warehouse setup. Further down was the hygiene bay, where the clients could sign up for showers and borrow lockable lockers. Across the lot was a facility called the Homeless Persons Health Project. I didn't completely learn the details about it then, but I know that volunteering medical professionals offered some basic healthcare services there. The kitchen was actually really nice. It had been built recently, so it was relatively easy to keep up, and overall, it was a reasonably safe and clean place to work. And, as would prove critical to me, it had a kitchen office upstairs and a lockable restroom in the dining area. These features both came in handy more than once, and without them, I probably would have lost the job even sooner. I don't know how many times, but more than once at that job, I felt that old deja vu feeling starting up, and I managed to get myself up the stairs to my office or out into that restroom behind the locked door, and had managed to lie down in time and somehow kept that job a-rolling. And more than once after a seizure, I had awoken having to face that I was too torn up to finish my shift, and my brother was called to come get me again. At first, the admin had looked the other way, but eventually I simply had to be dealt with. Even though I had disclosed that I had occasional seizures at my interview, no one, including me, really knew then just how disruptive the problem would come to be. As I got started there, one of the administrators had given me some real scoop about how and why things worked the way they did in this environment I was soon going to be in charge of. I'm very sure that his advice, along the way, helped me to work there as long as I possibly could have. I don't really know his history, but basically, he came across as a kind of low-key, middle-aged surfer guy. As I came to learn, he had a psychology background. He was therefore really good with his people skills and helped me understand some basic things about how people tick that really helped out a lot in dealing with the community I was feeding and working with the people that I was managing. Also, he was very understanding and aware of what my seizures could cause and involve. I was fortunate he was there. One of the most valuable tools I picked up from the guy was a little thing he called validation. See, I had moved from a job where you could never say no to a guest to a place where clients came to get free food and bitch about it. I think he was aware of that because as I got started, he explained that I was probably going to get frustrated from time to time in this environment. He was right, of course. He warned that sometimes I'd find myself busting ass and a client would demand my attention to share their feelings with the boss and it would probably piss me off, which likely would happen pretty often. So, his recommendation was that I learn to use validation like this. First, they complain and I act like I'm listening briefly, maybe make eye contact or rub my chin like I'm really considering their ideas or demands. Then, second, I hit them with a line something like this. Well, we are an organization that is here to feed and serve you, and we are always looking for ways that we can improve. So I'm really glad you took the time to tell me about that, and I'll see what I can do. Then, third, they feel validated, empowered, and walk away thinking, I told him. And fourth, I go back to whatever I was doing and probably totally forget whatever the hair up their ass was. So, everybody wins. Great advice. Next, I had to learn how to cook with whatever food I had to please this crowd. It wasn't always super simple. I learned quickly that the best way to see if I had come up with food that the clientele had enjoyed was by lifting the trash can in the dish room after meals to see how heavy it was, and looking in it to see what didn't get eaten. This was one of the first techniques I had developed when I was new on the job. I got a good lesson from one of the first meals I made. It was then late in summer, and a lot of donations had been coming in from nice people that had been dropping off totally gorgeous fresh veggies, usually the extras from their home gardens. New and naive as I was then, I had chopped up a whole bunch of stuff all pretty-like and made them into a nice fresh stir-fry served with rice. I remember that I was still out to prove to everybody there that I knew how to cook, and anybody that's ever cooked up large banquets or done catering for a living will agree that putting out cooked veggies that aren't totally limp and dead by the end of a meal is one of the skills that proves you're a pro. So, I had totally nutritious, tender, crisp stir-fry going on that I kept refreshing along the way for the entire meal. Somehow, though, every time I turned around and looked over at the dish window, trays were coming back from the clients with almost none of the main dish eaten. What the hell? Then, at the very end of that service hour, a little old lady came up to the dish window as I was looking at my hard work piled up in the trash, and like almost everybody else, she had eaten like none of her stir-fry. She looked at me and said, "You gotta cook your vegetables more so we can chew 'em." I realized right away that she talked that way because she had no teeth. I immediately put another two and two together. If something doesn't get eaten, it is not nutritious. Maybe this community wasn't eating my food because they were light in the tooth department, or maybe it was because they had never actually been taught what good healthy food is, but either way, if they didn't eat it, they weren't getting any nutrition at all. The next night, I had somebody open a ton of canned veggies and mixed them all together and heated them up, and they were almost completely chowed. Lesson learned. As I took over the management and ordering, I took this lesson to heart. Whatever I did, with whatever purchased or donated food, I would have to prepare it in whatever way it would be eaten by this crowd, or it would be a pointless and futile failure. At that time, the meals were served twice daily. The crowd varied greatly in size, depending on the time of the month. As my reality-deciphering boss had explained to me, at least back in those years, many of the people who were on whatever government programs routinely got checks at the beginning of the month. Most would then check into local hotels and spend up their money in whatever ways you might imagine. As their money began to run out through the month, more and more clients would then show up in the dining room line. The numbers fluctuated from as few as 40 persons at a meal to over 400 in tandem with the cadence of this tide. Once I had learned this, many fluctuations that were tied to this rhythm became obvious, the most notable to me being that there were clearly times when there were less or more people panhandling on the city streets. I had begun to watch the behaviors of the clients during meals, partially out of paranoia, admittedly, but also because I had noticed more than one crowd control issue that was causing some clients to get away with greedy behavior that was depriving others. For one thing, before meal times, all of the people would line up outside, and while some of the folks might have been waiting for quite a while, clearly hungry and having really nowhere else to be, others would show up right before mealtime and just cut right into the front of the line. Not cool. Worse, some people would take an entire tray of food, eat only the dessert, cherry cobbler or jello or whatever, and throw away the rest of the food. Then they'd exit, cut back into the front of the line, get another whole tray of food, and do it again however many times. By the end of the meal hour, we'd often be running out of food while some of the neediest people were continually getting shoved to the back of the line. By the time they finally got inside, we were scraping the bottom of our supplies. Meanwhile, the trash would be filling up with completely good food these bullying assholes were throwing away, only interested in getting a sugar fix. By then, I had been doing food service long enough to have the math skills to prove that we should have easily had enough for everybody, but instead, we were loading up the younger, meaner, tougher part of this community with however many servings of dessert they wanted, while those who needed us most were getting shoved to the back. But it was even more crazy. This bully group was also often cramming food into their backpacks so they could head back out into the woods and camp for a few days till it ran out. This meant that they wouldn't be coming back for however many meal periods. We therefore couldn't tally up our service to them, which could lower our funding, having an even larger impact on everybody's food. Of course, this definitely meant that days-old backpack-stored food would be consumed away from the HCSC, well after it was safe to eat, and it would certainly be fed to whatever kids and dogs were being towed around by this part of the crowd. Finally, as the director, I put my foot down. There was a security staff of several persons working on the property also, mostly guys, usually former clients, and they were in charge of breaking up fights, not letting people do their dope openly on site, calling cops or ambulances when needed, and all that ongoing crowd control type stuff. When the kitchen staff had problems with clients that we couldn't deal with easily, this was our go-to crew. I met with them and told them some new ways I was going to adjust how we did the food thing. They agreed pretty quickly that a little enforcement of a few new rules would go a long way, and it would make the crowd easier to manage. I explained that I was sure we'd not only end up with less security problems overall, but I'd be able to direct whatever money was being lost in the current format back into the food budget to improve the quality. We agreed to a few rules. 1. No cuts or you're out for the meal. 2. All bags stay outside. 3. No food can be taken from the dining room or you're going to go hungry until you talk to Nate and promise not to do it again. And 4. The big one. All of the trays would get filled with all of the items being served, which later was referred to as every tray gets everything, and only after we had fed everybody in line we would offer seconds, but no more seconds on dessert. So, if you had eaten everything on your tray but were still hungry, you could still get more food to eat, but this bullshit with throwing away everything but the sugar treat was over. One of the final modifications to service that I made was salt. I had been cooking long enough to know that for most people, being able to add salt, if desired, makes the food more likely to be eaten, and therefore to be nutritious. I also knew that there was no way I could put out salt shakers. They'd disappear fast. So, I set up a cable-fastened metal shaker at the end of the tray service counter, a big metal spice container with a thread on top. I took a segment of rubber-coated clothesline-type cable and wrapped it through the handle and attached it to some hardware I threaded into the counter underneath. And sure enough, almost everybody salted almost everything. It didn't take long to get the results I had hoped for. Some people threw their little fits and bitches and the security crew had to deal with them, but overall, I think most of the regular clients really appreciated the differences, and it showed in a few odd ways. For one thing, as I started buying and making better food, it was getting eaten better, confirmed by a gradually less heavy dish room trash can. For another, it was usually quieter in the dining room, with less conflicts going on. People were busy eating. I remember one client freaking out about whatever rule he didn't agree with and making a scene, and before I even needed security to help, a bunch of people who were already eating piped up and told him to chill out because the food was way better now. He realized he was outnumbered and simply succumbed to the peer pressure and shut up and sat down and ate his tray of free food. One event that really proved the success of the everyone gets everything rule to me was a meal that I served to an adult woman with her preschool-aged little boy. I'd noticed them eating there a number of times before. They were regulars. I could clearly see that he was usually bored, always being towed around behind his mom as she chattered away at other clients, chasing whatever the hot gossip was in the lot, while her kid just sort of always kept himself quiet as he stared at whatever litter he had picked up or tinkered with whatever flowers or bugs he had been fortunate enough to find to educate himself with. At one point, even though the mom already knew the rules, she began to tell the person putting the food on the trays that her son doesn't like this and won't eat that, and the server told her that everyone gets everything, and then handed a full tray to her son.
I don't think I'll ever be able to forget watching the two of them through the window in the kitchen door when they sat down with their food. As usual, she was getting up and sitting down repeatedly, bantering away at others who were also used to her and were clearly ignoring her as they ate. Then I saw a magic moment. The little boy picked up a canned green bean and looked at it with the kind of interest and fascination he might have had while he looked at the odds and ends he usually played with. He turned it over and over, inspecting the foreign item, and then he put it in his mouth. At first, he had his usual blank look, but then he chewed up the bean, swallowed it, and smiled, and then he ate every single green bean on his tray. His mom was too busy. She didn't notice. Then the little boy got up with his tray and asked the server for more green beans. It was the first time I ever saw him speak. Not that I had been keeping track or anything. I told the server to let that kid have as many of them damn beans as he wanted. It was clear he was needing them. I headed up to the office. I needed a minute alone because I thought I might just cry. And I didn't need the staff or the clients to see the resident tough guy boss lose it. As I sat there alone in the office, I realized that this little boy had just proved to me that I was doing at least something right. I couldn't help but wonder how many parents were out there dragging kids like that little boy around, feeding them whatever shuts them up for a minute because they don't have enough of their own self-esteem intact to even begin to teach their kids what healthy food is or why they should eat it. Somehow, reaching around some of these detached parents and slipping some nutrition into their innocent and malnourished kids was a critical part of why I was there, and it was one of the best ways I could make sure that the people who contributed to that facility were getting at least some real success out of their wonderful intentions. This was just one of the many experiences I had at that job that led me to understand a bigger, underlying meaning to the picture I had found my own place in. The lesson I was learning so often boiled down to the core problem of lack of self-esteem. People who thought they were worthless or had no chances left to be something were the source of my own bread and butter, yet this looming presence of hopelessness was, and will always be, my enemy and the enemy of so many well-meaning people that just want to help. Sadly, we don't always have the resources, and we certainly don't always agree on ways we can effectively attack this beast we call poverty. One thing most of us can understand and agree on, though, is that no matter what, it is not the kid's fault. And some of the most effective weapons we really do have to fight with are the nutrition, education, and medical resources that a kid like that one little boy needs to ever break out of such a terrible cycle. This chapter, which describes my experience as the food service director of the Homeless Center of Santa Cruz, California, from 2001 to 2004, will be continued at the beginning of the next episode, the fourth in this podcast series. This concludes episode 3 of Chefaleptic. Episodes are posted weekly, so come back for seconds if you're hungry for more. Sorry, no dessert with seconds. All music used in this series is original. This time, both the intro and exit music comes from a tune called Breakthrough from my 2017 release, Tough Lucky. If you'd like, you can hear and download lots of my music for free here at natebnt.com, and it's also at many free music sites. A blog, printed version of this series is also posted for those who'd prefer to read, with new episodes posted weekly as well. For a sources cited reference list, go to the end of the blog section. I'll be making an ongoing effort to make sure the list is as complete and accurate as possible. Till next week, stay swell, well, fine, and free.